So they captured Jericho, and they've taken Ai, and they've read the law at Ebal, and built an altar there, and in other words, they've made a claim to the land. And, well, the nations and the land, I'm going to let that lie. So let's have a look and see what happens thereafter. There's one little group who have their own plans and ideas about this, and it's on in chapter 9. It came to pass when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills and the valleys, all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard thereof, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel in one accord. So there was a grand alliance formed against Israel at that time. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard of Joshua and Dan and to Jericho and to Ai, they did work wildly, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses, and wine bottles old, and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clouted upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. They went to Joshua and to the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him, and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a league with us. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? And they said unto Joshua, we are thy servants. And Joshua said unto them, who are ye, and from whence are ye come? And they said unto him, from a far, very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of the Lord thy God, for you have heard the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt. And all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, we are your servants, therefore now make ye a league with us. This our bread we took hot for our provision out of our houses on the day we came forth to go unto you, but now, behold, it is dry, it is mouldy, and these bottles of wine which we filled were new, and behold, they be rent. And these our garments and our shoes have become old by reason of the very long journey. And the men took up their victuals, and asked not counsel of the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them, and made a league with them, to let them live. The princes of the congregation swear unto them. It came to pass at the end of 3 days, after they had made a league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors, and that they dwelt among them. The children of Israel journeyed, and came unto their cities on the third day. And the cities of Gibeon, and Jephirah, and Beeroth, and Kirjath Jearim. And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel, and all the congregation murmured against the princes. But all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. This we will do to them, we will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us, because of the oath which we swear unto them. And the princes said unto them, let them live, let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised them. And Joshua called for them, and he spake unto them, saying, wherefore have ye beguiled us, saying, we were very far from you, when ye dwell among us? Now therefore ye are cursed. And there shall none of you be freed from the bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told thy servants how that the Lord thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you, therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you, and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in thine hand. As it seemeth good and right unto thee to do unto us, do. And so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, and they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation, and for the altar of the Lord, even to this day, in the place that he should choose. And so, the story of Gibeon. When I come to this particular chapter, in a sense, I feel as if my clothes have already been stolen by Joel then, as he's already commented on this chapter. However, we'll look at the chapter and see what we can draw from it. Now, you'll notice, of course, the chapter begins with the word and quite obviously that connects us with what has gone before, and it has that intention. And it tells us, of course, that these people heard of the defeats of their neighbors at Jericho and Ai, and the victories of the children of Israel. And, you know, they also had heard of the defeat of the children of Israel at Ai. Every defeat of a Christian is an encouragement to the world. And they heard of the religious ceremony at Ebal, and they had heard of the Israelites claiming the land as if it was already theirs, as they were already masters of the land. So they band together to fight. And the verse 1 and 2 tell of the alliance against the children of Israel. And that alliance is going to be broken just now by the defection of the Gibeonites. Now, Gibeon was one of Canaan's royal cities. It was a town of the Hivites. It was known by its neighbors as a great city. It was located in the hill country about 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem and about 6 miles southwest of Ai. So it wasn't very far from the town they had recently conquered. Knowing that the God of Israel had commanded his people to destroy all the inhabitants of Canaan, and they state that in verse 24, the end of the chapter, their plan was not to resist Israel, but to somehow to trap Israel into a protection pact, a covenant which would be binding and in which their lives would be saved. So what they do is they pose as ambassadors from a far country because they apparently knew that though the Lord stated that the nations in Canaan were to be destroyed, it did not say that about nations outside of Canaan. In fact, the book of Deuteronomy made provision for the Israelites to make coalitions and pacts with nations outside Israel. Now, if you turn to chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, you'll see where that is stated. And in Deuteronomy chapter 20, and verse 10, this is what it says. When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace, and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that are found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword, the women, the little ones, and the cattle, and all that is in the city, even the spoil thereof, shalt thou take to thyself, and shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies which the Lord thy God hath given thee. Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations, that is the Canaanite nations, but of the cities of these people which the Lord thy God hath given thee for inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them. So, in Deuteronomy, they told that whereas the nations inside the land are to be utterly destroyed, outside the land, there was this possibility coming against the city, to fight it, and proclaiming terms to it, peace to it, and if they agreed to terms of peace, then of course the city would become tributary to them and would be their servants, would serve them. These cities had to be far off, not within the land. You notice that in the plan of the Gibeonites, they came from a far off city and they pledged themselves to be servants, which is what would have happened if they had come to such a city and spoken peace to it. But that was only for cities outside the land. And where they did not speak peace, the city was to be destroyed, the males thereof slain, but the children safe. But that only applied to nations, cities outside the land. Within the land, all were to be slaughtered. So somehow or other, these Gibeonites must have some knowledge of this particular requirement, this particular statement of Moses, and they were taking advantage of it. They had found a way out, a way of deliverance in this, and they were going to take advantage of it. Now, it says they wirily pretended to be ambassadors, craftily pretended to be. And so they come and claim to be from a far country, because a covenant of peace, they knew, could only be made with a country outside the land. Or other nations inside the land were to be destroyed. And so they come. Now, let's notice, when it says craftily, let's notice what it means and how they work this out. So you will notice what they say to the Israelites when they come. First of all, they tell them that they come, verse 6, from a far country. And they repeat that again in verse 9. And in answer to the questions of Joshua, they say they come from a very far country, and they'd heard of the fame of the God of Israel and all that he did in Egypt. They'd also heard of all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites, to Sihon and to Og. And they stop there. They don't go any further than that. They make no reference to the victories of Jericho and the victories of Ai. Well, they wouldn't, you see. They came from a far country. And they knew these things which had happened a long time ago, but things which had happened more recently, they weren't yet aware of. I mean, if they had said that, they would have given the game away. So they didn't make any reference to Jericho and Ai. So they were being very crafty about this. As far as they were concerned, you see, the news of these events had not yet reached these strangers from a far country. Something else happens here, because what they do is they use a bit of flattery. Verse 9, Joshua, or verse 8, who are you, from whence are you? And they say, from a far country thy servants are come. As if to imply that the fame of Israel's God and the fame of Joshua was such that Joshua, as the representative of that God and the leader of the people of Israel, was being courted by people from a far country. So they were being flatterers too, and you remember that one king fell for that, apart from Joshua. Because in the story of Hezekiah, whereas he withstood Sennacherib and Rabshakeh, the official of Sennacherib, when the ambassadors came from the Chaldeans, he showed them his treasure. They came and presented him with a letter from their king, and he was impressed, flattered, that these people should come so far. Just then, so he showed them his treasure. He fell for it. Well, they were flattering Joshua a little bit with this particular thing. They were come from a far distance. You know, we always need to beware of flattery, difficult to handle. And they used it here in this particular case. Notice again, in verse 9, he asked the question, who are you? And you know, to that, they don't make a direct reply. They don't say, we are Gibeonites, that we give the show away. So they say, well, we're from a far country, but they don't say what their nationality is at all. They don't make a direct reply to that. What they do, they evade the reply by saying that they are prepared to become his servants. We'll be your servants. And so Israel a little suspected that these Gibeonites were the very Canaanites who they commanded to drive up the land of promise. Now, the Gibeonite stratagem wasn't a particularly profound one. And it wouldn't have been one too difficult to detect. But, you see, Israel were slightly at a disadvantage in it. They had little experience of the things that the Gibeonites were presenting them with. You see, they, like the Gibeonites, have come from a far country. They come from Egypt. They've been in the wilderness. But they knew nothing of patched clothing, because their clothing had not waxed old upon them. And they knew nothing of shoes which were in disrepair, because not even their feet swelled so within the 40 years of wandering, neither did they footwear need repair. And of bread, moldy bread, they had no experience, because God had supplied them with manna, so they had no need of bread. And as for water, well, they didn't carry broken down water skins, because God supplied them daily with water. And of worn garments and stale provisions, they had no experience. And so the Gibeonites went undetected, because they were handling things, bringing things that the Israelites knew very little about. And now notice the response of the Israelites. Verse 7. Suppose you dwell among us. How shall we make a league with you? Well, that was impossible. They were to be wiped out if they were amongst them. So the Israelites were instructed in this. And they realized it would be wrong to agree to the suggestion of the Gibeonites, if the Gibeonites were those who dwelt amongst us. But I want you to notice again what they say. They say this: suppose you dwell among us. That's a strange statement, isn't it? I mean, bit of a nerve, eh? I mean, these people have just entered, crossed the land, and all they got up is up from Jericho up to Ai, and they're already saying, well, you know, are you really wanting to dwell among us? As if the land was already theirs. See, that was their faith. They claimed the land already as theirs. So it's, you dwell amongst us. They'd only arrived, and all the others were around them. And then you notice something else, that they didn't immediately grant the request. They do express distrust here. But then, of course, they accepted the Gibeonite story on the basis of their moldy bread. And verse 14 tells us, and the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. Now, that was sad. The thing which they didn't do was ask counsel of the Lord. You will notice, of course, how they are described, these Gibeonites. Verse 7, and the men said unto the Hivites. Well, now, I want you just to stop for a moment with that name, because they occur in the history of this nation much earlier on. They occur, in fact, in the 34th chapter of Genesis, where we read of Hivites. And there was a man there whose name was Shechem, and his father was a Hivite. And you remember what happened to them. That they were deceived by Jacob's sons over the matter of Dinah. And having been deceived, they were tricked and killed. Interesting that the very people whose ancestors, forefathers, were deceived by these Israelites, or their forefathers, are now deceiving the people who deceived them. Chickens sometimes come home to roost, as the saying says, and it did in this particular case. Now, what should Joshua have done? Well, I suppose that, you know, in this particular situation, it was a difficult one. The answer is given to us in the Epistle of James. It's something which I tend to remind myself when particularly we have difficult problems in relation to a local assembly I'm with. And you know, in the Epistle of James it says this: if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And I find myself very often in that particular situation. And Joshua could have taken that resource. Lacking wisdom, he could have asked of God. But what is more, there was a means whereby Joshua could have found out the will of the Lord in this and found guidance from God. And if you turn back to the book of Numbers, you will find what that was. The book of Numbers. Chapter 27. That is, we looked at it earlier sometime. Verse 18. And the Lord turned to Moses, take thee Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay thy hand upon him. Set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation, give him a charge in thy sight. Verse 21. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of Urim, before the Lord. And so, he was a means by which Joshua could have found God's guidance. He could have gone to Eleazar and asked, as before the Lord, counsel of the Lord by this means here indicated. Now, at Ai, Israel trusted its own strength and was defeated. And here, Joshua and the princes trusted their own wisdom, didn't pray, and they were deceived. And they relied entirely upon their own discernment. They didn't ask counsel of God. I suppose it might have been that in the presence of strangers, they were unwilling to show themselves, lacking the wisdom to handle the situation, or to declare themselves at a loss, and they could do nothing without humbly carrying the matter to the Lord and praying for guidance, and they didn't seem to want to do that. You know, it's always wrong to act on our own judgment instead of seeking to know the will of the God when we come to problems of difficult choices. We should lean not in such cases to our own understanding. Again, you notice that they were deceived by appearances. Well, patched up clothing, worn out shoes, moldy bread, that was an appearance, and they were deceived by it. Now let's go and notice what else happens here and just see what the result of all this is. Of course, ultimately, deception is going to be out and going to be found out. And the Gibeonites are telling a lie. And nothing justifies a lie in God's sight. They profess that to honor the God of Israel. They say that in verse 9. They have come because of the name of the Lord thy God. It may be, of course, that they never heard that that God was a God of truth. But they had tried deception, which would sooner or later be found out. The book of Numbers has that little verse which sometimes you see quoted. You sure your sin will find you out. And so it did. But what about these Israelites? Well, let's just examine their situation for a moment. What they did was they made a compact, an alliance, an agreement, a covenant with these Gibeonites. And as a result of that, because it was binding, they were thereafter to live with the consequences, always. And, you know, we might make wrong decisions and be obliged to live with them and the consequences afterwards. But the government of God came into this particular situation because of their mistake, and they had to suffer the presence of these people with them forevermore. It was always a bitter thing to find out that your confidence was being misplaced. And that those who you thought trustworthy and commended to others have proved to be untrustworthy and have disappointed you in that. But now that they found that these people with whom they had made this agreement, that they were, in fact, the Gibeonites up the road, just 6 miles away, and that they're being deceived. The one thing to their credit that the Israelite princes would not do
is they would not break the covenant. It had been sealed with the oath of their God.
Now, that's even more interesting when you read verse 18. Because when you read verse 18, it says, "And all the congregation murmured against the princes." Now that's a pretty large number to murmur against the princes, because there were 2 million of them. And they murmured against the princes. They wanted revenge. They'd been duped. It might have been that they wanted revenge because they were allying with some of the people of the land, which the Lord had forbidden. Or it might have been because they had been taken in. But they wanted revenge. Now, the princes stood firm. And they stood firm against the murmuring of the people, and they stood by the covenant they had sealed. They were doing righteously in that. They had sealed, signed the covenant, and put the name of their God to it, and they were standing by it. But they were, at the same time, getting a rough time from the rest of the people of Israel. You know, it's a practical point there, I think. You know, if you and I contend for truth and that which is right, we will not escape opposition. We will expect people to oppose us. They will always do that. But the princes recognized the sanctity of the oath that they had taken with them. They were jealous for the honor of their God and the sanctity of that oath. You know, it's not immoral to violate an oath, a vow, rather, when it would be a sin to keep it. And when you look at the case of Herod Antipas, he swore a foolish oath, but it led him to the grievous sin of the murder of John the Baptist. And one looks at the morality of the situation in that particular case. But to have executed the Gibeonites would have brought upon them, the Israelites, the charge of perjury, and would have brought the occasion to the heathen and the nations of Canaan to blaspheme the name of their God and to rightly regard the name of Jehovah. And so they stood by it. And even against the opposition of their own people. You know, sometimes agreements are made, and at the end of the agreement we feel we've been imposed upon. I suppose the Israelites went, well, have been felt to have been imposed upon. But at the same time, when that happens, we're not to think ourselves at liberty to retaliate. And when we make solemn engagements, even sometimes to our hurt, they have to be kept. And God would have us keep our words at all times, even though it might be to our own wrath. And so they were prepared to keep their words. Now, sometime later, there was the attempt to break this oath of Joshua. And you'll find it in the book of Samuel. And it was undertaken by Saul. And I think, if I hope I've got the passage right, 2 Samuel. Or is it 1 Samuel? Let me check that. I thought it was 1 Samuel then. 1 Samuel, I think. 21. 1 Samuel 21. We have to resurrect Saul if you put him into 2 Samuel. No, I think I've got the wrong passage of it. 2 Samuel 21. Well, that's what I said first of all. I was doubtful about that. 2 Samuel 21 verses 1 to 8, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. There was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year, David inquired the Lord. And the Lord answered, "It is for Saul, because he slew the Gibeonites." King called the Gibeonites, tell them, the Gibeonites are not the children of Israel, but the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel sworn unto them. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel, and
Judah. And what happens in the passage actually is that retribution is effected upon the house of Saul for it. And seven of his sons are executed as expiation of the crime of Saul. Saul attempted to break the oath which Joshua had taken on this one occasion. Now, let's just stop for a moment, because we've been looking at the Israelites. Let's just think of these Gibeonites for a minute. You know, what were these Gibeonites really looking for? Are looking for a compact, alliance with Israel? Well, yes, they were. But was that really what they were looking for? The Gibeonites, 6 miles from Ai, had heard of the destruction of Ai, and it was the destruction of Jericho. And what they were looking for was deliverance. They were looking for mercy. And in their feeble way, they believed in God's power and in His protection. And He was able to give them that protection. And so as God looked at these men, He must have looked at them as they came, in a sense, begging for their lives. And He saw the meanness of their action, and He saw the deception which they were engaged in, and He saw the lying which they called themselves, all those things He was cognizant of. But He saw something else. He saw a faith which believed that if they threw themselves, even in this deceptive way, upon the mercy of God, God in His great mercy would yet deliver them. God saw their faith beyond all that outward thing, and because of that faith, poor and low as it was, He showed them mercy. You know, God's grace triumphs over man's folly. And the curse which Joshua placed upon them actually turned out to be a blessing. And I want to say to you, probably not much greater blessing could you imagine than that which turned out for them. Because what happened to them was that they were made hewers of wood and drawers of water. But what for? For work at God's altar. For work in God's house. And what would have been true of them, I'm sure, is what is said by the psalmist in Psalm 84. And if you turn to that, there's a scarcely more lovely verse here concerning the character of service in God's house. And verse 4 says of Psalm 84, "Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be still praising thee." And that is where the skewers of wood and drawers of water went. That's what they were to do. They were attached forever to the congregation and to the altar of the Lord in the place that He should choose. And such is the grace of God. And He took people who came in their deception, and yet in their poor and deceptive way were trying to express that they were casting themselves upon the mercy of God, and God took them and He placed them in this position in His house. And you know, when you go to chapter 10, you find that in chapter 10 there was a battle at Bethoron, and it was for them He wrought the battle at Bethoron. They pleaded, called upon Joshua, and Joshua responded readily and delivered them from their foes. It was afterwards, amongst them, before the building of the temple, that He pitched His tent, because the tabernacle until the building of the temple was at Gibeon, though the altar was taken, propitiatory was taken to Jerusalem. And in later days, when priests and Levites failed
We find in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah that they took their places. So Gibeon then, in subsequent history, was one of the places where the tabernacle was until the building of the temple. And the ark too was lodged in a Gibeonite town. It was lodged in Kiriam, which is one of the Gibeonite cities, until David brought the ark out to Jerusalem. And the Gibeonites were devoted to the sanctuary service, and were later called in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah by the name of Nethinims, and you find the name Nethinims way there in those books. Sorry. Singers, yeah, right. And the task, of course, they were given is expressed here. They were tasked in service of the house of God at its altar. Woodcutters were water carriers. But interestingly, they should be there. Because being there in the house, they were no longer in a position to influence others, they who had been idolaters. But they would be healthily exposed to the revelation of God in all the work which went on in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And so God's grace brought them glory and joy. Say, one other point about them is that when you read the list of God's mighty, of David's mighty men, you will find the names of Gibeonites in the list of David's mighty men as well. And they will find their names in the builders of walls in Nehemiah's day. And one thing which is said about them, not said about them, is that they betrayed their trust. And throughout their history, what you read of them subsequently is they never appear to have betrayed their trust, and they never appear to have enticed Israel into idolatry. They consistently were there, even at the return from the captivity. Men to whom God had shown mercy. Now, I don't know if there are any questions about that. We'll ask you to answer them if there are. If not, we'll take to five. Sorry, okay, Joe.
As we had said so briefly yesterday at the session, you can't help at the end of all of these wonderful things that you shared with us, but make the connection, of course, to ourselves. Yes. As you've wonderfully stated, you think of a group of people that, because of their rebellion against the Lord, of course, in previous generations, ought to have been destroyed, but because of an act of grace by a man named Joshua, they now find themselves participating not only in the worship, but in the service of the Holy God of Heaven. And as I often say, the difference, of course, between the Gibeonites and ourselves is the Gibeonites were actually only 5 miles away.
That's right.
Who could ever measure how far was yes. how far yes. I was away yes. when the Lord took mercy on me?
Yes. What they were saying in the deception was actually true in our part. We did grew up from a far country.
This is just a cheeky comment. It's nothing to do with the message today, but we quite often as believers find ourselves very naive in front of a certain situation. And as you said, we need to seek the Lord. But I read this little joke, if you wish, about the two tourist bus drivers who were talking to each other. And one of them, he said, I had an excellent group this morning. They call themselves Christians. So he said, what do they believe? He said, anything I tell them.
The connection between the Nephilim and the Gibeonites, how was that connection made?
The connection between them?
Yes.
Yes. The work they did, you'll find the connection in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, if you read those there, and the name given to them. And their function is in the, is stated as being that which you find here. Of those who wouldn't, and who would have, yeah. 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 Well, let's have a break then for 5 minutes, and we're keeping the time this afternoon, by the look of it, so that's good.